For the sermon reading today, we're back in Genesis chapter 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was over the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. And God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. And God saw the light was good. And God separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening, and there was morning, the first day. And God said, "Let there be an expanse in the midst of the waters, and let it separate the waters from the waters." And God made the expanse and separated the waters that were under the expanse from the waters that were above the expanse, and it was so. And God called the expanse heaven, and there was evening, and there was morning, the second day. And God said, "Let the waters under the heavens be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear," and it was so. God called the dry land earth, and the waters were gathered together, he called seas, and God saw that it was good. And God said, "Let the earth sprout vegetation, plants yielding seed, and fruit trees bearing fruit, in which is their seed, each according to its kind, and on the earth." And it was so. The earth brought forth vegetation, plants yielding seeds according to their own kinds, and trees bearing fruit in which their seed, each according to its own kind. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the third day. And God said, "Let there be lights in the expanse of the heavens, to separate the day from the night, and let them be for signs and for seasons, and for days and years, and let the lights in the expanse of the heavens to give light upon the earth." And it was so. And God made the two great lights, the greater light to rule the day, and the lesser light to rule the night and the stars. And God set them in the expanse of the heavens to give light on earth, to rule over the day, over the night, and to separate the light from the darkness. And God saw it was good. There was evening, there was morning, the fourth day. And God said, "Let the waters swarm with swarms of living creatures, and let the birds fly above the earth across the expanse of the heavens." So God created the great sea creatures and every living creature that moves with which the waters swarm. According to their kinds, every winged bird according to its kind, and God saw that it was good. And God blessed them, saying, "Be fruitful and multiply, and fill the waters in the seas, and let the birds multiply on the earth." And there was evening, and there was morning, the fifth day. And God said, "Let the earth bring forth living creatures according to their kinds, livestock and creeping things, and beasts of the earth according to their kinds." And it was so. And God made the beasts of the earth according to their kinds, and the livestock according to their kinds, and everything that creeps on the ground according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the heavens, and over the livestock, over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." So God created man in his own image. In the image of God he created him, male and female he created him. And God blessed them, and God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the heavens, and over every living thing that moves on the earth." And God said, "Behold, I give you every plant yielding seed that is on the face of the earth, and every tree with seed in its fruit. You shall have them for food. And to every beast of the earth, and to every bird of the heavens, and to everything that creeps on the earth, everything that has breath of life, I have given them every green plant for food." And it was so. And God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the sixth day. Thank you, Des.
Yes, the first point we considered last week about what the Bible teaches about God is that it assumes that God is. It never tries to prove God's existence. But nevertheless, it tells us that God is evident in nature and in the hearts of men and women made in his image. But then secondly, we said that the Bible also assumes that God is eternal and that in the beginning he pre-existed everything. God was self-existent, that he predates and postdates time and space as we know it. And from those two points, we deduce that when God did create, what he created, the heavens and the earth, is both creaturely and distinct from himself. And I said if we believe those two presuppositions, then that makes us firstly theists. We're not pantheists who confuse God with creation like animists and to a good degree Hindus do as well. And then secondly, it makes us creationists, those who believe God to be the creator. And everything else that there is from God, other than God, his creation. And then we briefly looked at that first word of the Bible, the word Bereshit, or beginning, which we said was anatheros. It could be translated beginning or a beginning. There's no there in it. And because of that, certain people, in particular the gap theorists, have based their doctrine on that. And we ruled out that gap theory on foundational and theological and exegetical grounds. And so now as we turn to Genesis 1:1 again this week, and as we try to eliminate certain difficulties and also to postulate what may be the best way to frame this chapter, the first thing I want to ask of verse 1 is Genesis verse 1 an independent clause or is it a subordinate clause? Let me explain that question. Firstly, to take verse 1 as an independent clause means that that sentence is complete in and of itself. It means there's nothing necessary grammatically to be added to that sentence to make it say what it's saying, for it to mean to make sense. It has all that it needs to be rightly understood. It has a subject, a verb, and an object. So as an independent clause, we would translate verse 1, in the beginning, God, subject, created, verb, the heavens and the earth, the object. So it's a complete sentence. But to take verse 1 as a subordinate clause means that the sentence is incomplete, and it's only made complete by adding other information. And some scholars do in fact see verse 1 as being a subordinate clause, which is complete, incomplete, and only completed by adding, for example, verse 2 to it. And so they would translate this in this way. When God began to create the heavens and the earth, verse 1, the earth was without form and void, and darkness was over the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters, verse 2. So you can see in that case, verse 1 is an incomplete statement, which is only made complete when verse 2 provides the information to complete it. But to complicate things a little bit further, some hold that instead of verse 2 supplying the information to complete the sentence, verse 3 should instead. And that verse 2 should be seen as a kind of parenthesis. And in that instance, we would translate verse 1 like this. When God began to create the heavens and the earth, verse 1, incomplete clause, then parenthesis, when the earth was without form and void and darkness was over the face of the deep, then the added information, God said, let there be light. Now, in effect, the third way of translating is the same as the second. But here verse 1 is completed by verse 3. God said, let there be light, instead of verse 2, which is a parenthesis, which is descriptive of the unformed state of the earth. Now, to be fair, from a grammatical perspective, all three translations are acceptable and have been supported by reputable scholars. So a knowledge of the Hebrew language alone can't decide what's the best translation. In fact, the New English Bible, the New American Bible, the Revised Standard Bible all translate verse 1 of Genesis as a subordinate clause. But by contrast, the New American Standard Bible, the New King James, as well as the original King James, the NIV and the ESV, all translate verse 1 as an independent clause. So does it make any difference how we translate verse 1? Or are we just quibbling with words? And I'd suggest that there really is a way, there is a difference, and it's an important difference in how we translate verse 1. And that's because of a couple of reasons. And firstly, in terms of sentence structure, one of the basic characteristics of Hebrew sentence structure is that they're usually, not always, but usually, they're simple in construction. And that unlike our English or the Greek, where it's common for us to have complex sentences, the use of subordinate clauses and parentheses and so on, the Hebrew sentence is generally speaking quite short and to the point. So in terms of Hebrew style, and especially so with didactic matter, as in this first chapter of Genesis, it's firstly far more in keeping with the Hebrew to translate verse 1 as a simple, short, independent clause. But then, more importantly, if we take verse 1 as a subordinate clause, the danger is that we leave the door open to allow that it wasn't only God who was existent at the beginning. And that's because the use of the subordinate clause implies when God began to create the heavens and earth, when the earth was without form and void, there appears to be that the earth is already existent. That's the sense you get from it, and maybe why some of the translators suggested that. It suggests in a sense that God created from something. But if we take the traditional translation, incidentally, which the older translations hold to, the Septuagint, the Vulgate, then the door is firmly shut against anything other than God being the only one existent in the beginning. And so the sense would be in the beginning, at the very start, God alone created the heavens and the earth from nothing. Now that doesn't directly answer the question which translation is grammatically correct. But as an independent clause, it does theologically support and guard what the rest of the Bible teaches about God, who alone is eternal, and that the universe is his creation. And as we referred to support that from Hebrews 11 last week, we read there that it's by faith we understand that the universe was created by God's word, so that what is seen was not made out of the things that are visible. So for those good reasons, I'd suggest that Genesis 1:1 should be translated as an independent clause, as a standalone sentence. I can imagine someone here this morning thinking, but is all this really necessary? Independent clauses, subordinate clauses, definite articles and arthrous nouns. I didn't sign up for this every Sunday. And while I appreciate the problem, I think it's at least necessary to be aware of the issues, even if at times we struggle to grasp them fully. Why do I say that? It's because of the importance of the matter that we're dealing with. Not only because it's God's word, which we want to rightly divide and apply to our lives, but also because no book in the Bible, other than this, has been so powerfully and subtly attacked by the enemy in order to undermine it. And it's as if every jot and every tittle in some way, in some sense, over the course of history has been attacked and manipulated in a persistent attempt to discredit or to confound the truths of the book of Genesis. And if you've done any studies in the book of Genesis, you'll know exactly what I mean. It was the beginning, really, of the whole higher critical movement. And from the issues, authorship, dating, to composition, structure, to theology and interpretation, no other book has sustained such a prolonged attack right to this day at the hands of the enemy. And I think that begs a question. Why do you think that is? And I think the answer is very evident. It's because the devil hates the truth that reveals his lies. And when that truth is foundational to all truth, then to discredit it or to blur it will mean in some way or another that all truth will be discredited or at least blurred. And so in a very real sense, the fight for Genesis is a fight for truth. And we at least need to be aware of the issues and to have reasons why we say what we believe when the foundations of truth are being eroded even in our day. And so we need to be those who know how to rightly divide the word. Now, if we're happy with that explanation for our being particularly careful in our approach to framing this first chapter, and if you're happy with verse one, with that verse one for the reasons given should be taken as an independent clause which stands on its own, then the second question I want to ask of verse one is in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth a title or is it an act? And I wonder if you've ever thought about that as you've read through Genesis. Because, again, both suggestions are possible and both carry implications. Firstly, then, some scholars think that verse 1 is a title of sorts to introduce what's going to follow. Something like this. Verse 1, title, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And then verse 2 to chapter 2 and verse 3, a verse-by-verse detailed description of how he did that. Now, Victor Hamilton, in his two-volume work on Genesis, and one I'd highly recommend for the serious exegete, he says, verse 1 is a superscription and a summary, a functional equivalent to a colophon. Well, to cut through all of that, what he's really saying is, it's a summing up of what follows placed at the top as a title. And so for Hamilton, one of the reasons he sees verse 1 as a kind of title is because it logically works as a genealogical divider, where verse 1 refers, if you like, to the genealogical division of the beginning of the earth, after which the other dividers speak of the division of mankind, which followed through Genesis. And so Hamilton is saying, this is the generations of the earth, how it came to being, how it was formed, how it was populated. And it's the first superscription we see of the other 10 superscriptions written through the book of the Bible. And that, from that perspective, I think there's a lot to be said for the way that Hamilton views verse 1. But then there are others who believe verse 1 is not a title, but an act. And that statement, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, is in itself God's first creative act. It's this creative act, we might say, that created all that constitutes the substance and which forms the essential building blocks of the entire creation, and from which everything else, stage by stage, day by day, was made. And importantly, in that way of framing it, it teaches that God is a God of order. Picture it like this. In the beginning, God created the mass substance of universal proportions out of nothing. And amongst and a part of that initial stuff was the earth, formless and void. Darkness was over the surface of the deep, the watery deep. And the watery deep encapsulated the earth in its primordial state. And the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters, covering the unformed earth. That's the initial state. And then God calls forth light. And light emerges from darkness. And then day by day, in the light, God brings forth his glorious work. Now, sometimes people ask, where did this light in verse 3 come from? Since the sun didn't appear until verse 14. Surely there's a problem here. Surely this is an indication of the unscientific mind of the author and an indication of human errors in the writing of Genesis. Well, maybe the light issued from God himself. Because remember, when we read in the book of Revelation, in the new heavens and earth, there will no longer be any need for sun or moon, because God and the Lamb will be the light for the redeemed of his people. So in essence, there's no need for the sun for light, because God is light and God will illumine. Or maybe it was that the light issued at God's command from the stuff he originally created in that creative act in verse 1 in the beginning. And maybe the reason the earth failed to be illuminated except by God's intervention was because of the watery womb with which it was enveloped prevented the light from being seen. We can't really say, but it really doesn't matter. It's a non-issue. Because the real point being brought across here is that God and his processes are orderly. That God brings forth in stage by stage, from nothing to something, from darkness to light, from chaos to order, from preparation to population. And according to that orderly process, extended over the 6 days, he fashions the earth for man's habitation. This is the end in view, the earth being fashioned for man. Day one is the calling forth of light and the separating of darkness from light. Day two, there's a separating of the waters from the waters and the creating of expanse, sky, heavens. Day three, there's the separation of the waters on the earth, producing dry land, a place for man to live, and producing vegetation, food for man to eat. Day four, the heavenly lights ruling over the earth and her days and her seasons. Day five, aquatic creatures and winged creatures according to their kind. And then land creatures capped with man, day six. So verse one then, taken as an act, is the foundational act which prepares the way for which everything else is going to be brought forth from. And in doing so, it declares the God of order. So in response then to our two initial questions about Genesis 1, I think the best way to frame this and to answer those questions is to say that verse 1 is an independent clause, not a subordinate clause. And verse 1 is better seen as an act the first creative act of God and not a title. That sets us up, therefore, for what we're going to say is going to come from that. So now let's turn again, as we did last week, to the first word of Genesis chapter 1 and verse 1, the word Bereshit, or in beginning. And you'll remember I said that Bereshit was anarthrous, and maybe it was deliberately so as to emphasize a qualitative sense, a beginning of beginnings, if you like. But what I really find interesting about this anarthrous beginning is that the initial part of verse 1 in the Hebrew, including the lack of the definite article, word for word is repeated by John in his prologue in the Gospel. And if you were to look at John 1 and verse 1 in the original Greek, it would read something like this, en arche ein ho logos, or in beginning was the Word. And where en means in, arche means beginning. And if John wanted to say the beginning, he would have written en hei arche. But he didn't. And he chose to write beginning anarthrously, just as in Genesis 1. And then we would translate ein as was, and ho logos as the Word. And there's the definite article, ho logos, the Word. So we translate literally, in beginning was the Word. And it's argued that John deliberately used this anarthrous NRK, again, firstly, to stress this qualitative beginning, this beginning of beginnings, but also because he consciously had Genesis 1:1 in mind when he wrote those words of the prologue in his gospel, and that he deliberately wrote as he did in order to shock his readers back to Genesis 1 and verse 1. And that's because it was that beginning of beginnings, before anything was brought into existence, in the eternal self-existence of God Himself, that John wanted to say that the Word, who is Jesus Christ, was likewise eternally existent with God. That verse 1, in the beginning, the very beginning, was the Word. And the Word was with God. And the Word was God. So that verse 3, all things were made through Him, and that without Him was not anything made that has been made. You see, what John was so careful to teach at that very onset of the gospel of Jesus Christ was that Jesus, who was revealed in the flesh, was also the pre-existent eternal Word, and who was with God, and who was God, and who created all things, and without whom nothing was brought into existence. Now, does that sound like something we've been deliberating over these last couple of weeks? Haven't we been saying the same things about Elohim, God, in Genesis 1:1? That He is? That He's eternal? That He predates creation? And that He's the distinct and personal Creator who created all other things? And haven't we hinted in our initial introduction that at the complexity of the being of God in the plural Elohim, and especially in the phrase, let us make man in our image? And isn't John's distinction in the phrases concerning the Logos who was with God and was God also inferring complexity? And a like distinction, Elohim and Hologos in the being of God, and also that they are distinct from creation? Do you see the parallels? But then, to push the boat out a little further, isn't there a third person at least hinted at in verse 2 of Genesis, where we read, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. Who's this other entity associated so closely with Elohim, God, and with Logos, the Word who was God, here in the beginning of the universe? Who's this Ruach Elohim? Not mighty wind, as some have wrongly suggested, on the basis that wind and spirit come from the same word Ruach, and that El can mean in a certain context mighty or great. Because a mighty wind would be gusting, not hovering over the earth. And besides which, a far more appropriate word would have been used if that's what the writer intended. So who's this Ruach Elohim, this Spirit of God? Because he too, with Elohim and Logos, is there before creation. And he too is distinct from creation. And clearly, he too is an agent of creation, hovering like an eagle over her brood, personally attended to this embryonic planet still in state of gestation. So what are we saying about these things? What are we saying? Well, we're saying this, that if we've grasped the implications of word structure and usage and sentence structure in Genesis 1, and if we've ruled out perhaps other alternative translations, what we're saying is that John's theology of Jesus Christ in John 1, and later his theology of the personal and divine spirit in his gospel, are undergirded by what Genesis 1 and 2 say. And conversely, that Genesis 1 is expounded by John in his gospel. And that together they confirm not only John's understanding of the deity of Christ, but also his theological undertones of the Trinity. And importantly, unlike the gap theory that's founded on a gap, and which finds no support but plenty of contradiction in the rest of the Bible, John's Trinitarian presuppositions, whilst lacking the clear definition and term Trinity, nevertheless is founded from as early as the first two verses of Genesis 1, and has such consistent and copious support in the rest of the Bible that it would be unforgivable for us not to see it or to dismiss it. But that rather it infers that in the beginning, God the Father and God the Son and God the Holy Spirit, the triune God, one God in three persons, created the heavens and the earth. What an absolutely devastating, astounding revelation. Who could have thought of it? Look at any other ancient Near Eastern cosmology, Babylonian, Sumerian, Egyptian, and you'll not come even remotely close to this creative account in Genesis chapter 1. And you'll not come even remotely close to the God who is revealed as the Creator. And that's because there is no other ancient extant writing that comes near to what verse 1 teaches when we study it closely, and especially so in relation to the rest of the Bible. And the reason for that is because this book is the revelation of God, not some distorted, mutilated, illogical, mythical work of man's reason. And when we read Genesis, and when we study Genesis, we need to come to it in that frame of mind. This is, in a very real sense, beyond us. Let's not try and put our own presuppositions upon it. Let's not carve our own way from modern reason to try and make it work for us. Let us remember that we're dealing with God's Word that, in a very real sense, is beyond us. Let's thank God for it. It's the beginning of all things. It's the beginning of God's self-revelation. It's the beginning of the history of the universe. It's the beginning of God's eternal purposes for man working out. Greater things are coming. When this God in the person of his Son, the eternal Logos, enters into the creation, under its created laws, in order to suffer and die to redeem his elect to himself. And then the greatest is yet to come, when he will come again and restore this created order to a new heavens and earth. Oh, may God open our eyes and help us to see the wonder of what he's teaching us here in these words. Let's close, shall we?